Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Today we're going to be talking with David Talbot, who is arguably one of the most accomplished journalists of my generation. He's the founder and former CEO and editor-in-chief of Salon, and since leaving Salon, he has really transformed to a historian, publishing a number of fascinating books, including two on the Kennedy administration and assassination, the first, Brothers, the Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and then the book we're going to be talking about today, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. It's reviewed on the website at Soleri.com. I must say, if you want to understand the Kennedy administration, the assassination, and the early years of the CIA, I consider it an absolutely must read. So, David, welcome to the Soleri Report, and congratulations on such an incredible achievement.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. It's high praise coming from you, so I appreciate that.
Well, when I read it, you know, in my review, I described it as beautifully written, and one of the reasons, and obviously you're a very capable writer, but you weave so many complex threads at both the sort of macro and micro level, because you're working around the intimate picture of Alan Dulles. And to bring in those different threads and do it in a very elegant way means that not only did you have to do very significant research, but I appreciate the kind of chronology and outlining and production you had to do even before writing. So to me, this is a extraordinary intellectual effort. It's clear you invested a great deal of time in this. And so it brings, it makes the question that I always ask much more intriguing, which is, why did you write this book?
Well, this is a story that's been haunting me throughout most of my life. I'm 64 years old, and I felt that the very day that President Kennedy was killed on November 22, 1963, when I was 12 years old, that the America I knew, that America that had been taught to me in the schoolroom and by my parents, was not the real America. In fact, Bobby Kennedy said something to that effect after the terrible events in Dallas. And I think many, many Americans felt that this really stomach-churning sensation after that, that the world we knew was not the world that we had been taught to believe it was. And so, you know, like many, many Americans, it continued to haunt me over the years. And as I grew up and as I learned more about this period and the Cold War period and the secrets and the lies and the dark labyrinth that American people were not allowed to look inside, I was determined as a journalist and then later as a historian to do whatever I could to shine a spotlight on those dark chambers. And I began to do that, as you said, with my book about the Kennedy presidency, Brothers, and then continued that with this new book about Alan Dulles and the CIA.
Well, it's interesting. People often ask me, what's the problem with the economy? And I always say secrecy and the privilege that results from it. And interestingly enough, I think to end that secrecy and privilege, you need to go back exactly to the Kennedy assassination. So your book is very on point. So let's start with Alan Dulles, because Dulles is a very enigmatic person. He really isn't somebody who's in the popular culture. And this is a very important biography and sort of study of Alan Dulles. So tell us a little bit about Alan Dulles, why he's important, and what his role was in creating and leading the CIA.
Well, you're right. He has been largely lost to the mists of time. But in his day, he was a very well-known figure for a spy master. You usually associate spies with, of course, the shadows. But Alan Dulles was very happy being in the public spotlight, public eye. He and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who were this dynamic duo, Of course, Allen ran the CIA and John Foster Dulles ran the State Department under Eisenhower. And Allen really dominated U.S. intelligence throughout most of his career, starting really during World War II and with the OSS, the agency that paved the way to the CIA. And throughout this period, you see the Dulles brothers and their circle, because I don't see them as mavericks. These aren't rogues. These are people who are very much rooted in the American power elite, as C. Wright Mills, the sociologist, I think the great scholar of American power who wrote the book The Power Elite back in the 1950s, he termed this group, who mostly men, of course, overwhelmingly men, who had very high positions on Wall Street. The Dulles brothers ran the most powerful law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell, and they kind of shuttled between those worlds of high finance and the world of intelligence and national security in Washington. They kept popping up in these posts, no matter who happened to be president. They thought that they were above the president, and of course they did operate above the president in many ways. And in the case of Allen Dulles back in World War II, he pursued pretty much his own policies when he was stationed in Switzerland as the top spy for the OSS in continental Europe. He pursued secret negotiations with the Nazis. He and his brother had represented many of these high Nazi officials as their lawyers before the war, and they continued their ties to these Nazi business figures and political figures throughout the war. And in defiance of President Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender, which was formed at Casablanca, a famous conference between Churchill and FDR, we're not going to negotiate with any Nazi officials. We're going to crush this evil regime and bring them to justice. Dulles didn't get the memo, so to speak, although he did. But he, in defiance of FDR, he, as I said, you know, was cutting deals and secretly meeting with Nazis, because his main goal throughout the war was to preserve what he could of Nazi power, of German power, and to turn it against the Soviet Union, who he thought of as the primary enemy of the United States all along, even though, of course, the Soviet Union was taking the terrible brunt of the war and losing over 20 million dead. He thought they were the main enemy, and so he wanted Germany to emerge as a very strong counterforce against Russia after the war.
But you almost see, and it comes up in your book, because I think this is a very important aspect of what you call the, or Peter Dale Scott calls the deep state. It's almost as though you have a corporate metastructure managing financial investment, financial risk positions that umbrellas both sides, the Germans and the Americans, and you've got Dulles going back and forth, making sure, you know, the money is optimized while the two sides are fighting.
That's right. You know, yeah. He thought the war was just a distraction. His main focus was working with Swiss bankers and working with something called the Bank for International Settlements, which was a key financial mechanism during these years, presided over by Thomas McKittrick, a close friend, a Wall Street friend of the Dulles brothers, and someone who FDR and his Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, thought was a traitor. Because essentially, right, the Bank of International Settlements was the leading international bank for the Nazis. They stashed the loot that they were robbing from the slave populations of Europe as they invaded one country after the next, and laundering it in the Swiss bank, the Bank of International Settlements, and using that cash then to buy essential materials they needed for their war machine. So clearly this bank was part of the Nazi war effort. And again, as I say, it was the president of this bank during the war was this close Dulles friend, Tom McKittrick, a Wall Street banker. When Tom McKittrick comes back to New York during the war on leave, on a vacation, the Roosevelt administration wanted to arrest him and put him on trial for treason. And yet he instead is celebrated while he's in New York by the corporate and financial elite at a party at the Waldorf Astoria. And when they try to prevent him from going back to Switzerland, the Roosevelt administration, John Foster Dulles, again, this very powerful Wall Street lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, steps in and intercedes on his behalf, and he's allowed to return to Switzerland to continue working with the Nazis. So this is a whole alternate history that most Americans aren't aware of. And as you say, it's kind of a higher-level story about how finance and politics really works. It's not the kind of history we get from Steven Spielberg or from, Ken Burns. This is the story of how American power and international power works in the shadows.
Right. It's the our subscribers, we've explored this a lot, but I think there's still a lot more to understand about what happened during World War II. And I too, have experienced from government officials this sort of rabid fear of the Russia, and that is the number one long-term risk, which I've never quite been able to understand. One of the things I wanted to point out to you was, of course, I'm sure you know this, the BIS was literally created to be a central bank of central banks.
That's right.
And it's quite unusual that a central bank of central banks, the ultimate wholesaler, would be handling a retail account for the Nazis. So it's a very unusual thing for the BIS to be doing. And that's,
and of course, on the board, of course, of the BIS under Thomas McKittrick are all these Nazi officials who later would be put on trial for war crimes. So, you know, men at this level of power really don't worry about it, you know, temporary things like wars or ideological conflicts. What they're, you know, focused on is profit, and they're maintaining their own power. And they think that supersedes mere things like democracies and presidents and elections and wars and so on.
Right. Okay, so I want to talk about Brothers. Your first book on the Kennedy administration was Brothers. And it really evolved, you know, it organized around this extraordinary relationship between John and Bobby Kennedy. And I was into the Devil's Chessboard, and I realized, wow, you know, John Foster and Alan Dulles, Talbot's doing it again, exploring this intimate relationship between brothers. And in both cases, you see an intimate collaboration between two very ambitious brothers that creates extraordinary political leverage, both for the Kennedy brothers and the Dulles brothers. So tell us a little bit about Brothers and how you came to develop this specialty in exploring this political brother relationship.
Well, I guess, Catherine, I'm fascinated by dynasties because power often works that way, where you do have a family that is very well organized and very committed to the idea of maintaining their power as part of a larger power structure. So, of course, the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, the Dulleses intrigue me. You know, in a way, I thought I was writing a real-life Game of Thrones, and if you're familiar with that. You know, the clash of dynasties, the sort of ruthless pursuit of power. I was watching, I'm a big fan of the TV version of the HBO show, and I was watching it while I was, throughout the time I was writing this book. And really, you know, it seemed to me in some ways that this story was even more savage and more, you know, creepy in some ways than the fictional Game of Thrones. So, yeah, I think that, you know, in the case of the Kennedys, you know, what fascinates me is how sometimes there's a rupture within the American power sort of system because of outside events, because of traumatic things that occur in historical episodes. And certainly in the case of FDR, going back to that dynasty and the original clash between the Roosevelt dynasty and the Dulles brothers, you have the Great Depression, you have World War II, and in many ways there was this rupture within the ruling circles in this country. Look, Franklin Roosevelt was obviously a product of that world. He went to the same elite schools with these men, like the Dulles brothers. He knew them at the clubs on campus and socially and politically. And so in some ways, Franklin Roosevelt was exactly what the Republicans accused him of being, and many people in his circle. He was a traitor to his class. because he realized, of course, that American capitalism was in such a great crisis that the only way to really save American capitalism was to take extreme measures, regulatory measures over Wall Street, and for the government to step in and play a major role in our economy. And, of course, he was reviled for that by other members of his class. It was similar, I think, with the Kennedy brothers. Their great crisis, of course, they were confronting was the Cold War. Ted Sorensen, who was JFK's devoted speechwriter and aide, I interviewed Ted at great length before his death, and he said that he believed the main reason that Kennedy decided to run for president, because he was deathly afraid that the country would stumble over the precipice into an accidental, perhaps accidental or even intentional, nuclear war. Of course, throughout the Dulles period in the 1950s, John Foster Dulles at the State Department is constantly threatening the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam, in China, in Berlin. It was called nuclear brinksmanship, this policy. Eisenhower signed, off on that policy, and the two of them had a kind of blithe attitude about the use of nuclear weapons as if they were just, a standard conventional weapons. In fact, Eisenhower used the word, it's just like using another type of bullet. So this was a terrifying notion to young Senator Jack Kennedy, and he began to speak out more and more against Dulles' foreign policy, whether it was nuclear brinksmanship or the kind of interventionist cloak and dagger activity that Allen Dulles was engaging in at the CIA. As a senator, John Kennedy realized that third world nationalism, the spirit of liberation sweeping the world, Africa and Asia and the Middle East, was, you know, the winds of the future, that the West couldn't stop it, that as the old colonial empires, European empires crumbled, that the United States should get on board with these winds of change and not try to resist them. But the Eisenhower and Dulles, regime was strongly resisting these, new nationalist movements. And in fact, Allen Dulles was doing his best to kill foreign leaders like Patrice Lumumba and others, who they did feel were threats to American corporate interests, mining interests, agribusiness, oil, and so on throughout these regions. So in many ways, young Jack Kennedy was way ahead of his time. And some of the speeches that he was delivering as a senator in the 1950s, where he's siding with these revolutionary changes overseas, are quite remarkable to read today.
You know, one of the things, would you say it's fair to say that Kennedy wanted to move to a multipolar world and Dulles and his group wanted to keep it unipolar?
Absolutely. And Kennedy even articulated that in a number of speeches, including one very eloquent speech he delivered at the University of Washington in Seattle in 1961, I believe it was November of 61, where he said, look, we represent just a fraction of the world's population, the United States. We can't expect to dominate the world the way that we've been, because obviously we were the sole superpower that really came out of World War II. Even the Soviet Union, of course, had been devastated by the war, and its economy was in shambles, and we had complete nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union for many years. And Eisenhower and the Dulles brothers used that superiority to threaten and cajole and exploit much of the world. But Kennedy said that era was coming to an end, and we had to adopt, as you say, a multilateral, multipolar way of looking at the world. The United States was not going to be the sole dominant force in the world, and we had to learn to accommodate these other rising nations throughout the world.
So here's my question. It's very elegant the way you do it in the book. You lay out the evidence and you leave it to the reader to decide, you know, who took what role in the assassination. But it's fair to say any reader worth their salt is going to conclude, you know, it's the establishment, it's the military-industrial complex, it's the deep state, and clearly Allen Dulles played a very critical role, certainly probably in the design of the assassination, I would say, but certainly in the cover-up. But here's the question. Why kill Kennedy? Why not just engineer his loss of the next election?
Well, I believe killing Kennedy was a last resort that these people took. They didn't take it any, it was not a precipitous thing they did. They pondered it, I think, very carefully. But I think what they determined was that Kennedy was going to indeed be reelected. He was very popular. The South was going to be a problem because of his civil rights policies. But I think they determined he was going to make up for the loss of the South in other areas like California and other parts of the country. And I think they did the math and they figured out, he had it. In the bag. And so the only way that they could then short circuit what was beginning to look like not just the reelection of JFK in 64, but perhaps a Kennedy dynasty with Bobby Kennedy in the wings, as perhaps his successor after that. And, they couldn't tolerate this because, look, essentially what they saw Kennedy's doing was trying to end the Cold War. Not just trying to end the Cold War, but he again and again was coming up against corporate power, against financial power, in many other ways. Of course, the way that he cracked down on the steel industry that was colluding to raise prices in 1962 was a very traumatic event, actually, in American corporate history. U.S. Steel, taking the lead, attempted to break a deal that they had made with the unions and with the White House to keep prices down because, of course, the rising steel prices were a trigger for inflation, a major trigger for inflation in those years that rippled throughout the economy. And so JFK thought he had a deal with Roger Blau, the CEO of U.S. Steel, and then Blau stabbed him in the back and announced, no, we're going to break the deal and raise prices. Well, the Kennedy brothers came down like a ton of bricks on U.S. Steel. They raided, they had the FBI raid U.S. Steel offices, they seized files, they threatened to file antitrust suits against them, and they did. They had Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, pull contracts from Defense Department contracts from U.S. Steel. And because of all this federal pressure, the steel industry finally caved, and Kennedy won. But this was greeted with howls of rage, throughout the corporate world, in the corporate press, like the Wall Street Journal and Fortune and others. And he also was cracking down on overseas tax shelters for American corporations. He again and again was coming into conflict with the business world. But it was, I think, his efforts to end the Cold War, to establish back channel peace channels with Khrushchev in Moscow and Castro in Havana that really threatened, I think, the national security establishment. They felt he was going rogue. He was going off-road, that he was breaking this Cold War consensus that had been carefully developed since World War II in the highest circles in organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations. These private conclaves where power, whether it's corporate power, media power, national security people meet in New York and work out their policies. And Kennedy to them was a maverick. He was someone who couldn't be trusted. They thought he was an appeaser. They thought he was young, untested, that he was weak, that he was physically weak. They knew about his physical problems, his medical ailments. And I think their final analysis was, there's no way we can end this presidency without taking this very rash act organizing his assassination. And there's no doubt in my mind, and we can talk more about this, Catherine, if you want, that Alan Dulles was at the center of the only the plot to kill the president, but then the cover up as a member of the Warren Commission.
Right. I would say it this way: if you look at the unipolar world that they were managing, they had a model. And whenever you deal with economics or business or, geopolitics, you have a model. And if everybody's operating on that model and working on that model, and they have for centuries, if you try to change the model, you hiccup everybody and everything. And if you look at, 20 or 30 different decisions Kennedy made, he was hiccuping the model at every turn because he was completely reinventing the model.
That's right, challenging the oil industry on their tax write-offs, right. The oil depletion allowance, and so forth. You know, Dulles was very tied into the oil industry in Texas as well. His firm, Sullivan Cromwell, represented the major oil, tycoons in Texas. And I think, of course, many of them were also probably complicit, or a number of them were complicit in the plot against Kennedy as well.
Yeah, Kennedy believed in free markets, not rigged markets.
That's right. That's right.
So imagine if we had tried capitalism, what this world would be like. So let's go to the cover-up, because I think, to a certain extent, you know, the designing and the implementation.
You know, by the way, that he learned that from his old man, Joe Kennedy. He was a buccaneer capitalist. And as an Irishman, had seen how the system was often rigged by Yankee finance in Boston,
right,
and was very bitter about that. And I think, you know, as a young boy, JFK, you know, ingested a lot of his old man's bitterness about how the system is rigged, whether it's on Wall Street or in Boston and finance and so on. And, you know,
His old man turned into a pretty good rigor.
Well, that's right. He learned how to do it himself. But I still think there was a lot of bitterness there, that and distrust of high finance and of corporate capital JFK got from his dad.
So cover up, because I think the, you know, oftentimes in the corporate world, you know, the CEO doesn't get paid for executing the fraud. He gets paid for, you know, getting the cover up accomplished, because that's when everybody figures it's money good. So clearly the cover up was extraordinary. And my personal experience was that's when the arrogance went wild, was when the cover up succeeded. So maybe if you can talk a little bit about what you think the implications of the cover-up was to both our government and society.
Sure. Well, first of all, no one was better situated than Alan Dulles to play a central role in the plot itself to kill Kennedy. After Kennedy fires him following the disastrous CIA invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, Dulles doesn't go quietly into retirement in his late 60s. He goes home to Georgetown and continues to operate as if he's actually director of the CIA still. He keeps meeting with his top deputies, including a number of people who were later connected to the Kennedy assassination by the House Select Committee on Assassinations and other investigators. And I'm talking about people like William Harvey, who Dulles had made head of the CIA assassination team. Harvey was head of the team that worked with the mafia to try to kill Castro, among other assassination operations. And as I reveal in my book, William Harvey was spotted by his own deputy. He was stationed in Rome at the time in 1963, but he was spotted on a plane flying to Dallas in early November 1963 before the assassination by his deputy. And when his deputy, a man named Mark Wyatt, asked him, "Why are you going to Dallas, Bill?" he said, very evasive, "I'm going to just look around." Well, I think, and there's a number of other pieces of evidence I point to in my book, that Bill Harvey, who again had been Dulles' top assassin, was one of the organizers of the plot to kill the president in Dallas in November 63. And then after this terrible event, and there's a number of other things I point to, obviously, that connect Dulles to Dallas, he gets himself, lobbying President Johnson, the new president, he gets himself appointed to the Warren Commission, where he plays such a dominant role on this commission that a number of people thought it should have been called the Dulles Commission instead of the Warren Commission. He, again, isn't perfectly situated. Here's a man who all he has to do is pick up a phone. He can get the Sulzberger family, the owners of the New York Times, on the phone. He can get Kay Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, on the phone. They dine together. They belong to the same clubs. He is, you know, the sort of reigning symbol of the American power elite. And so the media quickly falls into line in this coverage of the Warren Commission. It was obviously a fraud from the beginning. It was set up to determine not who really killed the president, but to pin it on the convenient scapegoat, Lee Harvey Oswald, who, of course, shouted out to the press, "I'm a patsy," when he was arrested and he was in the Dallas Police Department. So he's able to get, you know, a very compliant media coverage. And in fact, I found a letter from the head of the Newsweek, Washington Bureau, thanking Alan Dulles profusely for helping guide their coverage of the Warren Report when it came out. And it went on to say something like, given what a tight deadline was, we couldn't have done it without you, Mr. Dulles. Thank you so much for interpreting the Warren Report for us and telling us pretty much what to print. So, you know, this is how the game was played in those days. There were very little dissent, and it was only on the margins in smaller publications. The New York Times was effusive in its praise of the Warren Report, the Washington Post, the Newsweekly, CBS, the television networks. They all fell into line. And, of course, anyone who dared to dissent was quickly marginalized and called a kook or a conspiracy nut or all the rest.
So my guess is both when he was designing the assassination or during the cover-up, the deep state is sending messages, you know, treat Alan Dulles as your, well, in this, you know, when the guys at the CIA are still reporting to him, the deep state is basically sending a message to the organization, you know, look to Dulles as though he hasn't been fired.
Yeah.
He's getting support from someplace.
I think John McCone, who Kennedy replaced Alan Dulles with as director of the CIA in late 1961, was a figurehead. He was not an old boy from the intelligence world. He was a Republican businessman from California. And he, you know, while he endorsed Dulles' Cold War policies in general, he was kept in the dark about the dirtier stuff that was going on, the assassination plots against foreign leaders and so on. So he, you know, and in fact, he too had a falling out with the Kennedy brothers, and they came to regret bitterly that they had appointed McCone. And that was one of their, you know, they repeatedly made those mistakes, unfortunately. They tried to appease the Republicans and keep them happy by keeping Dulles on as CIA director originally and then appointing this Republican businessman as his successor. Arthur Schlesinger, among others, who the famous historian who served in the Kennedy White House, aggressively lobbied the president to put a more progressive person in charge of the CIA, and in fact to break up the CIA and make it more manageable and more accountable to the president. But he failed to convince Kennedy, who I think one of his mistakes was, again, playing the political game, trying to keep Republicans happy when he should have just gone all out to remake his administration.
Right. Okay, pathology. The thing I've tried so hard to understand, and it starts with Dulles and his brother, but let's stick with Alan Dulles. We have a human being who is clearly appears devoid of any kind of empathy.
That's true.
You look at this guy and you say, okay, I'm not much of a psychologist, but does he have Asperger's syndrome? Is he basically a sociopath or a psychopath, or is this just the price of navigating between a deep state and that reality and believing in that reality and then an official reality, which is so Disney World compared to the deep state reality that you have no emotional, you know, you can't emotionally connect. Where does the pathology come from? Because it blossoms from Alan Dulles and his group into an entire, you know, sort of culture that we're now dealing with.
Well, absolutely. And I think you put your finger on, this is a fascinating question. It's one I had really, I think, lively discussions with my colleague, Karen Croft, who I dedicate the book to, who is my research colleague. And she did study psychology at Stanford and brought, I think, an important insight to the book about his personality, Dulles' personality, and his psychology. Look, I mean, they've done studies on power, and you know, most people who get to the levels of power, whether it's running the CIA or the White House or whatever, or a corporation, you know, have some degree of psychopathology because you have to. And in the case of Dulles, he would almost brag about all the people that he sent to their deaths, you know, ordering them into combat as clandestine agents. And he wasn't mourning this. As I said, there was a kind of a boastful aspect to it. He put his own son, who came back from the Korean War, where he'd served as a Marine and had been brain damaged by a piece of shrapnel, he put his own son in the hands of these cold and callous CIA scientists who, under the program codenamed MK Ultra, were doing unspeakable, experimental mind, testing, mind experimentation. He tried to do the same to his wife, who, a very distraught woman, had a lot suffered throughout their marriage, was a sensitive, artistic person. He tried to put her in the hands of a CIA psychiatrist who was notorious, who ran a program up at McGill University that was later exposed as a criminal, that where people were subjected unwittingly to massive amounts of psychedelics and other drugs to try and repattern their thinking. He fed into the jaws of Stalin and the Soviet security machinery an entire family who he'd known since the time they were children, as a way to sort of fool Stalin and into thinking that he was running a massive spy network within the Iron Curtain. Those people suffered brutally, the entire family, in the Soviet gulag as a result of these kind of chess games that Dulles was playing. So he was capable of anything. We were fascinated by his psychology. And in fact, we had some of our most interesting interviews, Karen and me, were with his daughter, Dulles' daughter, Joan, who was a retired Jungian therapist when we met her at her home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, had gone as far away as she could from her father's world, moved to New Mexico and become a Jungian therapist. And when we met her, was driving a Prius with an Obama sticker on the back. and she obviously has grappling with this her whole life, and said that there was a strange affect her father had. He treated his own children as if they were guests in his house. He took no particular interest or curiosity in them. Never really showed much emotion. The only time she ever saw him get emotional, he cried when he heard over the radio that France had fallen to Hitler. For some reason, that triggered some kind of emotion in him. But other than that, he was this distant, remote figure. She called him a benign figure. He never raised his voice. He never got upset with them. But he never showed them any affection either. So, his wife later writes in his diaries, and his diaries are just, I mean, her diaries, Clover, Dulles, are just painful to read, this outpouring of emotion. She says, he never asked me anything. He never expresses any interest in anybody unless he wants something from you. This very manipulative man who ironically was very charming on the surface, and people found him a great party guest, a dinner party guest, because he was a great raconteur and storyteller. So on the surface, he could be quite affable and avuncular, but underneath was this icy, cold kind of demeanor. His mistress, who I also was fascinated by, and I found her journals as well and her diaries, she wrote about one time when he was talking about the enjoyment he got when he saw people fall into his trap, his spy trap. He called them little mice, and he liked seeing their expression as the trap broke their little necks. And she was, obviously taken aback by this, but he didn't understand why she would be disturbed by that. So, yeah, it's clearly, I think, a psychopath. And someone who was a very high-functioning psychopath and able to, of course, turn on the charm when he wanted to, but suddenly this rage would come over him whenever he was crossed or he felt threatened, and he was capable of anything. And with Kennedy, you feel that too. I mean, you see that. He thought Kennedy was going to be this young man that he mentored, that he kind of controlled. And when Kennedy becomes president, of course, and pursues a very different policy than Dulles wants, he does fly into a rage. And later, I start the book with this. There, he's walking years later, and he's being interviewed by a magazine journalist in Washington about Kennedy. And he suddenly, this avuncular, figure turns into a, this rage comes over him. He says, that little Kennedy, he thought he was God. So even 2 years after Kennedy's been killed, Dulles is nursing this, this bitter rage against him.
It's interesting. The one thing I I've spent a lot of time looking at the assassination and the financial flows in and around it. So the financial incentives of, you know, the model and who's making money and then what happens afterwards, you know, and I'm always asking the question, qui bono? So who made money on the assassination is my way of sort of looking at what happened. But there are a number of, you don't spend a lot of time on the financial aspects. It comes up, but you're not, that's not your primary focus. But there were several tidbits in your description that gave me enormous ahas about the assassination. I just wanted to tell you because whenever you have a covert operation like this, let me go back. Before they had set up the CIA, John Foster and Allen are sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell. And there's a famous story from Christopher Simpson's book, Blowback, about how they...
Great book.
They took the money that they had seized at the end of the war, a portion of which had been moved into the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and they used that to rig the Italian elections in 48 for the at the request of the Vatican. And I sometimes say that the history of America is a history of how they replenished those slush funds. You know, they're always looking to replenish the slush funds
for the off-the-shelf operations. Yeah.
Right. So whenever you have a big operation like this, it's imperative to do two things. One is you don't want the markets to get scared. So you want to make sure that you're managing through the currency and the bond markets and the equity markets so you don't get a bad hiccup that can spiral out of control. Okay. So one, you want to make sure you manage those, but two, typically, the way you finance the operation is by insider trading it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be careful because it may not be successful.
Sure.
But great fortunes are made on not just sort of the changes in policy that occur afterwards, but literally financing, you know, financing the operation with its own profits.
Right.
And what you point out is, of course, on the day of the assassination, Dulles is not in town, he's in Boston and New York. And I thought, aha, you know, Boston is the equity, you know, the investment pools and some insurance, and New York is the trading and bond and fixed income and currency markets. And I thought, ah, okay, Allen's doing what he did in Switzerland. He's off coordinating with the money. He's trading
it. Well, and along those lines, another fascinating notation I found in his day journal, his calendar, was shortly before the assassination, a meeting with Doug Dillon, who, of course, was another fellow Wall Street figure, ran a major investment firm. And
of which I just want to point out, I was a partner and member of the board of directors of that firm after the Dillons had sold it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
In any case, and then, of course, he is Secretary of the Treasury. He's one of the Republicans that Kennedy has kept on in his administration,
right,
a holdover from the Eisenhower years. So what does he note in his day calendar, Dulles, before the assassination? He's meeting with Doug Dillon and, quote, the banker and bankers. So, yes,
right.
I think this is speculation, of course, but there's a good chance that that meeting was about how the assassination was being financed or what was going to be the repercussions of the assassination in the banking world. So
right.
I'm very fascinated by that. And, of course, Doug Dillon, as Secretary of the Treasury, happened to oversee the Secret Service, which
right.
melted away mysteriously in Dallas, in Dealey Plaza. There was no protection for JFK there.
Right.
And so Doug Dillon was never held accountable for that. When he was questioned before the Warren Commission later by a very friendly Alan Dulles, in fact, all blame was put on Kennedy for not having his own protection there and instead of the Secret Service. So,
well, the military is responsible for security.
Well,
I thought the military was responsible. And then, of course, you have the Secret Service right around him. But the military was responsible for overall security in Dallas.
Right. And the military was never held accountable either for its
right.
You know, poor performance there in securing the
right.
city or the Secret Service. They weren't reprimanded and in any way. And of course, there was no effort to investigate what really happened there. So, yeah, I am very interested in that. I do think there was an interesting connection between the Dulles brothers, speaking of finance again, and the Rockefellers. David Rockefeller,
right.
the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and his brother Nelson, who was governor of New York at the time, and another real power figure, someone who had also deep roots in U.S. intelligence from World War II on. And the Dulles right. brothers and the Rockefeller brothers were basically a team. So often right. when, again, as you said, they needed sort of a quiet black bag jobs done, operations done, and they didn't want the funding to come from official CIA budget, they went to the Rockefellers to finance these operations off the books. And, you know, who knows? There's a chance that the Rockefellers, there was financing involved there in Dallas as well. So they definitely had the same view of the Kennedy presidency, the Dulles brothers and the Rockefellers, as an aberrant presidency. They clashed again and again with him, particularly in Latin America, where the Rockefellers, the empire, of course, had wide assets and interests, in Standard Oil and even in supermarket chains in Latin America, and they felt the Kennedys were really screwing things up for them there with their Alliance for Progress program, which was basically empowering for the first time trade unions and empowering democratic organizations in these countries that had been under the, of course, firm rule of local oligarchies and of major U.S. corporate interests like the Rockefellers. And so, again and again, there were these points of conflict and tension between the Kennedys and the corporate world. And the Dulles brothers, of course, were the executors for that corporate world and had been throughout much of their career.
So here's one of the problems. To the victors go the spoil. And even though the men who killed Kennedy, at this point are mostly have passed on, their family names and their family fortunes continue. And, it seems to me that the children and the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren have terrible sensitivities about this story coming out. And so part of my question, and this gets to the media blackout, because I've heard you say that, that there's a media blackout on the book. Tell us what's been happening in terms of the response to the book and the media attention. And then let's talk a little bit about how do we ease the pain and that comes with bringing these things into the sunlight.
Sure. We'll talk about conspiracies. I mean, the American media just, it never ceases to amaze me. And I'm someone who spent my entire career in the American media now, 40 years later, about how lockstep, how Stalinist it is when it comes to, following the official party line, and blocking dissent, our so-called democratic media. Whether it's
so, can I just tell you one anecdote?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Some of Dulles's colleagues used to say to me, "Never tell the mice. The mice don't want to know."
They love to use that word, the mice, referring to.
They do. They love to use the mice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, that's exactly the attitude that continues to prevail today with the Washington and the New York media. All you have to do is look at the way that the Kennedy assassination was covered on the 50th year anniversary. It was just a torrent of one-sided coverage that pinned everything on Lee Harvey Oswald yet again, despite now the years and years of really terrific independent research and work done by the government itself, the House Assassinations Committee back in the 1970s. It was as if none of that existed. It was just the Warren Report, and that was it. That's 50 years later when, we were barraged with this Kennedy coverage then. In any case, when my book came out in fall, every book I've written up until this has been widely covered and reviewed in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the LA Times, and so on. This book, no. Was completely blacked out. Despite that, it became a New York Times bestseller. It was given a starred review in the very important book industry journal, Kirkus Reviews, and the Library Journal. Amazon called it a book of the month. New York Magazine said it was a book of the month. I mean, it wasn't as if, you know, this is some marginal little book. This is a book, a major book of revisionist history on American, power figures.
But it's impact. I mean, if you look at the research, it's impeccable. This is a serious work of history, and it's absolutely impeccable from everything I can see. And it's beautiful.
Well, thank you. No one has challenged it. That's the thing. No one has challenged it on factual terms at all. All they've done is willfully ignore the book. And in fact, when my publisher went to the Washington Post and the New York Times, they pointedly said, in the case of the Washington Post, we're not going to touch this book. I was due to go on TV on one show. I was in a car in Manhattan driven by my publicist, and suddenly he got an email saying the interview has been canceled. And when he, you know, was surprised, he emailed back why. He got a one-word reply. Politics was it. So this is the way the American corporate media works. When they don't want to acknowledge what you're saying, and look, I mean, I spend a lot of pages in my book talking about how the CIA has compromised our media and how, culpable the New York Times and the Washington Post and other journals are for playing the national security game. So they don't want that to come out. But to my great delight, you know, we don't have, fortunately, you know, the American corporate media can't control everything. We do have blogs. We have publications like Salon, which I started, Mother Jones and The Nation and others. And because of coverage, and Amy Goodman, God bless her, her show, Democracy Now! On public television, because of all that coverage, Tavis Smiley on PBS that I did get, the book did become a bestseller briefly at the New York Times. It was a New York Times bestseller for 1 or 2 weeks, I'm very delighted to say. And so I take great pride in that. The book is going into its 8th or 9th printing now. It's sold over 50,000 copies.
It's going to keep going.
It'll keep going.
It's going to be word of mouth. It's going to keep going.
I think people are just so eager to get this information, I think, Catherine, at this point. You know, we know in the year of Trump, look, our American elite, power elites, are coming apart. The Republican Party is shattering. The Democratic Party, I think, is also fraught with tensions. The old elites are fracturing. And, because of the great economic crisis I feel this country is still in, the suffering of working people and people who still have a hard time making a living in this country, the poverty levels. I live in San Francisco. It's like living in Calcutta. I mean, the numbers of homeless people on the streets in the city that's rolling in money because of the tech boom. And yet there's thousands of people living in tents and squalor on the streets. So, you know, you have a country that's actually coming to another kind of breaking point, I think, politically and financially. And
the model that Dulles and his brother tried to hold together is coming apart.
Absolutely. And so my book tells the backstory to that. How this, this power structure was built and why it has the seeds of its own destruction in it, because it's based on violence, it's based on exploitation, and it's based on now this widening wealth gap and power gap between this smaller and smaller elite that's completely out of touch with the rest of reality and the rest of our country. And now they're shocked to see these outraged people at the Trump rallies and people voting for Bernie Sanders. And, the corporate media just can't make any sense of it. So my book clues people in about this, and I hope they read it. I also tried to write it, by the way, as an anti-spy thriller, as I call it, as a page-turner. I'm a big fan of John Le Carré and some of the great Eric Ambler and some of the great spy writers, and so I try to write with that.
Well, it very much has the elegance of a Le Carré novel. It really does.
Thank you so much. I hope that there's enough cracks in the system for people to really start seeing the light. I hope they don't. Obviously, I hope that we don't go tumbling over the precipice of Trump.
No, we won't.
But yeah, I think that I'm an endless optimist, and I think at the end of the day that the American people are too wise. to go in that direction, and that we're going to wake up and we're going to demand something better from our leaders.
So one of my favorite lines from Leonard Cohen is he says, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through.
I love that.
So I think this book tore a huge, huge crack in the official reality. And it's, you know, and part of it is the quality is, I think when you, to do that, you've got to have extraordinary and very impeccable quality. And you managed to do that. And I know it was a formidable investment of your time and your energy. So before we end, you just have to tell us what's next for David Talbot. I've ordered your book on Smedley Butler. I didn't realize you'd written it until recently.
Yeah.
So I've got more David Talbot to read, but tell us what's next for
Devil
you.
Yeah, that book is called Devil Dog, which was his nickname for Marines. And of course, he was
that's a great name.
Marine hero. And then, of course, saved American democracy, heading off this coup, a Wall Street coup against President Roosevelt. So what's next for me? To tell you the truth, Catherine, I am exhausted after years and years of research these historical epics. So my next book is going to be something that's going to be sheer fun. It's going to be a political thriller set in my native city of San Francisco, my home city, where I feel all the kind of tensions of American life are coming together, whether it's the great sort of, the tech boom, as I described it, and the great wealth gap between the tech elite and the people on the street, and all the national security stuff that's swirling around Apple and Google down in Silicon Valley. So I'm a big fan of what, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and of course Stieg Larsson, the late Swedish novelist, was
wonderful,
investigative journalist, and he managed to put a lot of his political ideas into his thrillers, and that's what I want to do by writing fiction.
Have you seen the new article, I'm going to mispronounce your name, by Zabroff on surveillance capitalism?
I have not, no.
Okay, so if you're going to write this thriller, she's a retired professor of Harvard Business School. She's got she's working on a book. She's got a new big article. It's up on Solari if you do a search for surveillance capitalism. But it's a story we're going to highlight in the first quarter review, because she really picks up on the power of what's happening with the private search engines and social media to have very invasive surveillance that is used to harvest financially, and it's beyond what the government's doing, and it's very, very dead on point, and I think would be very useful for your thriller.
Well, I'm definitely going to read that, because I'm fascinated by how sort of the tech sort of elite has been held up to us as these great heroes, and of course in San Francisco, this is now they've really taken over the whole city, and in some ways have enslaved San Francisco politically. I will rush and get a copy of this book, Surveillance Capital.
Oh no, it's an article. She's working on the book. She hasn't published it yet. She has a couple of great videos.
So that's
I put them up on Solari.
Surveillance.
Yeah, I'll send you the links.
Oh, that's great.
Because I think it'll be very helpful. When the Snowden revelations first came out, I said, aha, Booz Allen is engineering this for Google and Facebook.
Right.
to throttle down the NSA. I don't know that that's true, but that was kind of my fear.
Well, you never know.
Okay.
From what I know, Ed Snowden's a hero, and he threw away his very promising young life to go into exile for the American people to save our democracy. So, we live in very strange times. I think things are cracking apart, but hopefully, as you say, the light is coming in as a result.
Well, I'm a child of the 60s, and one of our expressions is the bigger the breakdown, the bigger the breakthrough. So here we go.
Here we go.
Well,
put on
here, David Talbot, anything that we can do at the Solari Report to support your work. So let us know when the new book is available for order, or anything else we can do to support your work, because we think you're doing incredible stuff, and we want to do everything we can to promote and support you, okay?
I sure appreciate it, Catherine, and thank you for your work as well.
Okay, well, we'll let you know when this goes up on the Solari Report. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care.